Well, thank you very much for that beautiful music. At the men's weekend, I had the opportunity to stand next to BJ, and we were singing in congregational manner out in the beautiful outdoors. And when I was in Ambassador College, I'd learned how to sing some of the parts. But I don't often do it, and I won't say I'm very good at it, but the first song comes up, BJ starts singing the bass part, and I said, I know this bass part. So I started singing with him, and we felt so good together singing. And he probably said, oh, good, you know the bass part. And he goes, I'll do tenor. Verse 2 comes, he goes, tenor, and I'm like lost in the neighborhood going, where did you leave me? I didn't know how to get out of there. So after he saw that I was floundering, third verse, he comes back and sings the bass part again. So that's where we were. And he gets me out of that neighborhood. And the next song, he does it again. I thought, what is he doing? That's quite a talent he has. Finally, he says, I'll do a couple bass lines for you so you can get it down better. I enjoy singing the part, but I do appreciate those that have the talent to sing like this. I certainly do appreciate it very much. I've enjoyed coming here to speak to you when I take Rachel to camp. And this might be the last year I get to do it. We'll be starting full time in the work as of November. The Walkers will be retiring, and I'll be having to stay back in the two congregations a lot more often. But I do enjoy coming out here and seeing all of you and saying hi to all you that we're at the men's weekend together and Northwest weekend and some of the other events that we get to do together. We are in the midst of summer. I was telling somebody before church that I can count all the weekends that I've been home on one hand this summer. We get so busy, don't we? There's so many things to do. Even if you don't have activities like camp and work parties and vacations, camping, and all of those things that fill up your time, there's plenty of other things to do during the summer. Lots of yard work. I've got so much yard work, I don't know what to do with it all. I've got painting I have to do, wood cutting I have to do, home repairs. You guys all know this. You guys go through this. You ask yourself, how are you going to get it all done? Then you come to church, and they tell you to remember your faith, your God, your relationship with Him, and to put it first. How do you put God first when you're so busy? How do you put God first when your life is so hectic? You know, if you're retired, or as Mr. Walker says, you get tired and then you get retired, you might have more time on your hands and say, well, I have a schedule that I keep. I get up, I do this, I do this, I do this, and this is my daily routine. But if you have one job, or I know some of you have two jobs, maybe some of you have three jobs, how do you put God first in your life? When ancient Israel was going into the promised land, God knew that they would have distractions. God knew it was going to be tough for them. And I so appreciated Mr. Kester's time travel back to ancient Israel. And I have to tell you, I'm so proud of you, Mr. Kester, for the movie reference, because I know that's difficult for you, but you pulled it off. It was really good. But no, it was a very, very good presentation. I do appreciate that very much. Made it very real. Turn over to Deuteronomy 6. Deuteronomy 6. There were plenty of times as they were preparing to go into the promised land that God told them how it's going to be. He told them how wonderful it's going to be, and He warned them what they need to keep in mind, what they had to keep focused on. And here's one of these times that He was giving them a pep talk here. And it says here in Deuteronomy 6, verses 10 through 12, so it shall be when the Lord your God brings you into the land of which He swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you large and beautiful cities, which you did not build, houses full of all good things, which you did not fill, hewn out wells, which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees, which you did not plant. See, you remember when the thieves went into the land, it was perfect. It had vineyards. It had cities. The only problem is it had people that they were afraid of, but it was completely ready to inhabit. God was giving them rent to own forever, places to live that was fully furnished. All they had to do was obey, and it would be theirs forever. It says, when you have eaten and are full, verse 12, then beware lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the houses of bondage. Growing up in the church, I remember so many sermons where we just contrasted ancient Israel and the mistakes that they made. And we so many lessons we can take from it. And I remember thinking to myself, how could people who had God so noticeably around them, how could they forget? How could they turn aside? How could they do the things that they did? I mean, we have a pretty terrible world that we live in. And we don't have, you know, the miracles that they had at this time. Nobody's parting the Red Sea. Nobody is doing these things, calling fire down from heaven and having these giant confrontations like Elijah had, where faith was tested in a visible way. And so I remember growing up thinking, wow, they really missed out. They really messed up to have God in their lives that way and then forget him. But as I've gotten older, I began to understand that so many things they do and they did, we do in our own way in different ways. We become distracted in different ways. And you say, well, yeah, but we don't bow down to idols. Well, that's good. But we forget. We start off our days sometimes without prayer. We start off our days with the wrong attitudes. We go and live our days and weeks for ourselves. And we often miss the strong hand of God in our lives. That is the title for the message today, God's strong hand in our lives. If you don't see God's strong hand in your life, then now, while you're busy, when life is coming at you in technicolor, now is the time that you want to make a change and start looking for that in your life. You know, all through the book of Deuteronomy, God reminded Israel about what they needed to remember. And they would tell them, it's going to be this way. It's going to be tough. But if you do what you're supposed to do, you're going to be fine. Just remember to do what you're supposed to do. And then he says this toward the end of Deuteronomy. He warns them again in chapter 30, verses 1 through 5. Now it shall come to pass, when all these things come upon you, the blessings and the curse which I have set before you. And why does he say curse? Because he was explaining to them that they will stumble. He tells them before they get in there that you will stumble. You will make mistakes. He says, the blessings and the curse which I have set before you, and you call them to mind among the nations where the Lord your God drives you. So he's even saying, you're going to mess up so bad, I'm going to take you out of this land and I'm going to scatter you all over the world. Quite a scary warning to be given right before you are given the keys to your new place. And you, it says in verse 2, and you return to the Lord your God and obey his voice according to all that I command you today, you and your children with all your heart and with all your soul, that the Lord your God will bring you back from captivity and have compassion on you and gather you again from all the nations where the Lord your God has scattered you. We can easily get the wrong impression that Israel failed and so God has cast them aside, and that he's focused on us now. But Israel has always been God's people. And when you look at prophecy for the future, God's people will always be called Israel. And Paul talks about people being grafted into the family where branches were broken off. It's the same family. God's people are Israel. And we often suffer the same types of problems that they did, where we are eaten and we are full, and life just gets too busy to remember to put God first and to look for Him in our lives. Now, we've had miracles in our life. We've seen them in different miracles in different places. When I go to camp for the preteens, we'll generally get on this topic of miracles, and there's always a story or two somebody's got of something miraculously saved somebody, or somebody was healed from something, or somebody was spared some calamity. We all know those stories. We've told them ourselves. But it's not like you have what happened in Exodus all around us. It's not like what the stories that Israel had. We could say, oh, yeah, remember that time when God did that for us? And so you sometimes don't see the strong hand of God the same way. You personalize it. You have this thought about how God reacts with you and how you react with God. And it doesn't have the same kind of realism as we read through these stories. Do you see God's strong hand in the world today? We often talk about prophecy and how God is going to do these wonderful, wonderful things where it's going to be unmistakable. God's power and His strength is going to come back to this world, and people are going to be given that opportunity again, that witness and that chance to see God's strength. And we're going to see it. We're going to be here to witness it all. And we want to be there on the right side of God when it happens. And now we wait. We wait. You know, kings of old often made the mistake, as King Nebuchadnezzar did, as Mr. Kester brought up, when he was marching across the world and he was conquering everyone. At some point, Nebuchadnezzar made the mistake of saying, "By my hand have I done these things." And God let him know, "You didn't do anything by your hand." I think of some of the trials I've had in my life, and oftentimes that goes back to times where I forgot to recognize God's role in a particular area of my life. On our first men's weekend, we talked about some of the things that we see in society around us and how oftentimes the men aren't leading their families, and how they're not taking that first and prominent role in society. And they often, when you go into some social event, they will be the last ones in the room if they come at all. But oftentimes when at school events, the men, the fathers don't come. Maybe sometimes it's because there are no fathers in the picture. But even when there are fathers in the picture, they don't lead their families into the room. They follow behind their family. And it's generally the wives that are the social connections to all the other kids. And if the husbands talk at all, it's generally about work or something along those lines. And where I work at a community college, oftentimes I'll see a bunch of men talking together, and you never hear someone says, "You know, I'm so blessed to have my job," or "I'm so blessed to have this opportunity to go back to school. I have all these dreams and hopes and aspirations." No, what you hear oftentimes is a bunch of men standing around complaining about how what they have to put up with. The job that they had to put up with, that they quit to come back to school, and how they want to learn something so they don't have to ever have to deal with that again in their lives. By my hand have I been blessed. It's not just kings of old that have suffered through that. Each of us, in one way or in the other, have not given God the credit for things that He has done for us in our lives. Do you ever make that mistake? Do you ever take credit for something? Personally, I don't do a lot of, guess what I did? But I definitely have a problem where when somebody doesn't mention that I was involved in something, I think, but I was involved in that. And then I started getting an attitude about something that was a blessing to begin with. Then an idea that came to me that might have made something better wasn't my idea. It was something that God worked out in my life. And so we have to remember that God is first and foremost in our lives, that He is making those small miracles each and every day to get us through the day, to get us through the week, to lead us to a better place in our lives, not so that we can have prosperity now, but so that we can have a place in the kingdom of God. Growing up in the church, I just remember so many times where I just thought back on how Israel was so foolish. And if only we would see those kinds of miracles, we would never, never turn our back on God the way they did. And yet, we see God's hand in our lives and in the lives of what's going on in the world around us all the time. You know, when you read about an incident where God got involved and did something, we have an advantage over the people that the time was being written about. You know, you take the story of Gideon, for instance, and God talks about how he was going to do great things through a number of people. And we read God speaking to Gideon, and we read all the things that are going to happen. And then we watch Gideon react, and we watch what happens as a result. And then we say, well, good thing that happened. God did exactly what he said he was going to do. I knew he would. Not like I was turning to the next page going, I wonder if God's going to change his mind. Because we know that God's going to do what he says he does. But if you weren't in the room when God told Gideon what's going to happen, whose word did you take that God's going to do something? You know, for the people that are in some of these battles from the Old Testament, for the people that weren't in the room when God told Moses what he was going to do, you got to take it on faith. Kind of like we have to do today. God is at work in this world right now. Things are being worked out in ways that just don't make any sense, because God's plan is coming about. And we can't always tell what they are in advance. And oftentimes when we try to guess what God's plan is in advance, we get it wrong and then we look silly. But when we look back and we start to see God's hand molding things, there's an Israel again today. Why is there an Israel again today? Because there has to be. Prophecy tells us there has to be an Israel again. Prophecy tells us things are going to happen there. For hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, there was no Israel for any of this prophecy to take place in. After Nebuchadnezzar took all of Judah away, yes, a few people got to return in Nehemiah's time, and there was a remnant there. And you say, well, there you go. There was an Israel again. And then what happened? Then the Romans came. And after that happened, after 100 years after Christ, there was no Israel again. And for all this time since then, there was no Israel until our lifetime. And we know this is happening because God's strong hand made it happen. Turn over to Ecclesiastes 12. Solomon was one of these guys that, you know, there was a movie a few years ago called The Bucket List. Somebody was dying or believed they were dying, and they said, what would you like to do before you die? And he had this list of things he wanted to accomplish. And so one by one, they worked to accomplish the list so that they could experience something out of life and that life would have some sort of meaning at the end, and that having your life taken short, you wouldn't feel like you missed out, that somehow life was robbed. Solomon's the kind of person that had a bucket list where every single thing was checked off. He had a bucket list. He had more of a bucket encyclopedia. I mean, I wonder how many days he spent thinking, what is there left to do? what is there left to do? I can do anything. I've done everything. What is there left to do? In chapter 12, Ecclesiastes, Solomon looks back on his life of getting to do everything, having everything accomplished he could ever want. And he sits there and he reflects on his life. In verse 1 of chapter 12, he says, "Remember now your Creator in the days of your youth before the difficult days come." He's telling people, don't do what I did. Remember your Creator early in your life. Look for Him when you're young. He says, when the years draw near and you say, I have no pleasure in them. When life becomes difficult, when it just hurts to get up. It hurts to go through the day. While the sun and the light, the moon and the stars are not darkened, and the clouds do not return after the rain. In the day when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men bow down. All these things that happen to us when we age. We lose our sight, our hair, our hearing, our vitality. And you realize you could have had a better relationship with God. You could have had God in your life. Solomon had everything else in his life. Every possible wonderful thing. There was nothing he ever thought to do that he didn't get to do. And when it was all said and done, he was never, ever satisfied. Verse 6, remember your Creator before the silver cord is loosened or the golden bowl is broken or the pitcher shattered at the fountain or the wheel broken at the well. When it's too late, when your life is over and you can't go back and change, that is not the time you want to realize that you didn't take the time to look for God's strong hand in your life. We each have small victories each and every day in our lives. I can remember times that my life has been spared because of God's intervention. I have watched people healed of all kinds of different things, from simple ailments, simple things like a sore elbow that disappears immediately. You think, okay, how does that relate against something else that was so much more horrific? But God has mercy in so many different ways. And I've seen people healed of cancer. And I've seen people that God didn't heal. And only God knows. But you can't deny that God is there. That God is active in His church. And you can't deny that God is active in this world. There would be no state of Israel today if God was not active in this world. How many here remember the Yom Kippur War, 1973? Number of hands. It's a day of atonement. Israel was fasting and praying. And then Syria and Egypt decided that was the moment to strike. They had a 2-to-1 superiority over Israel. They were going to end this state of Israel that had come about in 1948, and they were going to make short work of it. They outnumbered Israel in planes, in tanks, in men, and in most areas they outnumber them 2-to-1. And they attack from two sides at once. And if you look at the map, Israel's not very easy to defend. It's long and narrow. The one area that Israel had going for them in 1973 is they had a pretty good air force. But as we learned in World War II, oftentimes the air force is the first to go when you're a victim of a surprise attack. And that's what it was. If it wasn't for God's strong hand, there would be no Israel today. If you were a betting person and you could find out about the war in advance and you saw the advantages that Egypt and Syria had, you would say Israel doesn't stand a chance. The outcome was decisive. Although both sides lost most of their aircraft and tanks, Israel prevailed, and the loss of soldiers were 9 Arabs killed for every 1 Israeli. And you think, that's pretty amazing. That is unprecedented in most modern warfare, except for when you have a superior force attacking and a very inferior force. In that time, you would see it, but not in the reverse. You never see a superior force attacking an inferior force and then losing 9-1. And that's what we saw. But this wasn't the first time Israel's neighbors tried to destroy them. Just 5 years earlier, in 1967, even more opposition came against Israel. Not only Egypt and Syria, but this time Jordan, Iraq, and Lebanon, supported by 7 other Arab nations, mobilized and didn't just attack Israel from 2 sides, but they were going to invade Israel from every side, from the sea, from the south, from the east, and from the north. They were going to come at Israel from every direction. But this time Israel struck first. They saw it coming, and they said, we are not going to allow this invasion to take place without us doing something in advance. It's now called the Six-Day War. It was over very quickly. Again, they were way outnumbered. And just as before, Arab countries outnumbered them more than 2-1. And they had better everything than what Israel had, but they didn't have the strong hand of God. And the bloodshed was even worse than what would happen 5 years later. The Arabs lost over 20,000 men. Israelis only 900. That's over a 20-1 superiority. Again, nobody was predicting that, of course, Israel can beat all of its Arab neighbors all at the same time. And why shouldn't they? God had done it before. But see, we don't get the advantage of hearing God say, today I'm going to give you a victory. We read that in our Old Testament and we say, yep, God's about to give them a victory. And we read those words, and then what happens? We put everything in our thoughts and our minds behind God's big, powerful, strong hand is going to do this wonderful thing. And we're convinced of it completely. But we don't hear those words today. And so when Israel does this miraculous come from behind victory, there are those whispers that says that was God's strong hand. But people in the world, you read Wikipedia about these battles, they don't mention God. They don't mention the obvious truth that there was no way they could have won otherwise. You know, once upon a time, God fought for Israel, and we never doubted the fact that God was there for them. And then when they failed, we didn't say, well, God wasn't there. When Israel was taken into captivity, we didn't say, well, God disappeared. We understood where the fault lied and why God didn't deliver them. But we have the benefit of our Bibles to tell us where the rocks are across the creek, to how to get across safely. And if you don't have that, you have to go by faith. We have these things in our lifetime that we have seen that we know are miraculous. And just because there's not a scripture we can turn to that says in the year 1967, God will do this wonderful thing, doesn't take away the veracity of God's involvement in our lives around us. Why is Israel here today? Turn over to the book of Daniel. book of Daniel, chapter 12. Mr. Kessler got us all ready to read Daniel this morning, and we can read it earlier today, and we'll read it again today. Daniel is a prophetic book. It contains many fulfilled prophecies of the rise and fall of Babylon, which we heard about earlier, Persia, Greece, and Rome, but it also contains many yet unfulfilled prophecies, things that haven't yet happened. And there's a prophetic phrase that is only used in Daniel and then quoted by Jesus in the Gospels. It's found at the end of the book regarding the end of days. After describing many of the end time events that God's people should watch for, in chapter 12 and verse 9, we read this. And he said, "Go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified, made white, and refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand." If you're Daniel hearing these things, what is he talking about? I mean, he just got done writing all these prophetic words, doesn't know what they mean. And he doesn't get to know because God says, go your way. You're not going to know. And from the time that the daily sacrifices is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. 3.5 years. Sounds familiar. Read about that somewhere. Something prophetic with 3.5 years. Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days, but you go your way till the end, for you shall rest and arise to your inheritance at the end of days. Now, some have seen, and I've read it, that it says, well, this prophecy was fulfilled in 167 B.C. when the Syrian ruler Antiochus Epiphanes invaded Judah, erected an idolatrous statue at the temple, and sacrificed pigs at the temple altar. But if it had been fulfilled completely there, then Christ wouldn't have mentioned it during the Gospels. And as we know, many prophecies have many different ways that it can be fulfilled, multiple times, in fact. In Matthew 24, we can read these words quoted by Christ. Matthew 24, verse 13 through 16. Matthew 24, verses 13 through 16. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom, which will be preached to all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. In other words, for thousands of years, people have read these words and didn't understand. Some thought it was what happened when the temple was destroyed. Of course, 3.5 years later, we're still here. The gospel of the kingdom of God was not preached, and then the end came. The end of Israel, as they knew it, came. The end of what they would see as God's people on earth, where they were dispersed and scattered and lost what most people felt was for all time. But we know that these words weren't fulfilled because the end time hasn't happened yet. There's still 3.5 years to come. And so it says when the sacrifices have ceased, and 3.5 years later, the end time will come. There has to be an Israel to fulfill this. How many people believe that this is a prophecy that was dead, could never happen? Not even God's strong hand can make this one come true. And yet, so many things we're finding out in this world today that the Bible had it right on. I remember growing up in the church watching the World Tomorrow program and Mr. Armstrong explaining how that when you have this information in Revelation that you have to understand that it's symbolic and it's not, these aren't literal things that you're looking at. These are images that explain things in a certain way, that you don't really have a modern Babylon. You don't really have a physical woman riding a beast, except that's where Europe got its name, from a woman riding a beast. That's where the name Europa comes from Greek mythology, and that the Parliament building for the EU is a recreation of the Tower of Babel. Without front, there's a statue of a beast with a woman riding on it. And that's over there right now, today. These images that we read in our Bibles are not just fables. They're reality that God's strong hand is bringing about in our lifetime. All we got to do is open our eyes and see it. We can read our Bibles. We can hear about talking about Babylon the Great. That Parliament building was designed around a painting. Around the Middle Ages, there was a painter who painted a painting of Europe. And in the middle of Europe was this Tower of Babel, and all of these people were coming back to rebuild it. It's because after the plague and the Black Death and all of the things that decimated Europe, this was the hope that Europe would somehow be rebuilt, would somehow come out of the ashes. And the imagery that they chose in this painting was of the Tower of Babel. Many people, many tongues, one mission. And they thought that was fitting to make that painting into their Parliament building. That idea. Of all ideas, to have somebody think, let's build a Parliament building based on something. Why would that be? Because God's strong hand is at work in our lives. When God's strong hand was in the Bible, we never doubted the authenticity of an event. But now we have to go by faith. When we see something, we think, what if God did that? I wonder if nothing else, we know God allowed it, but maybe God did that. How inspiring would that be? You know, you think to yourself, if I could have been there to see the Red Sea open, how inspiring would that have been? What would that have done to shape your life? And yet we have events going on around us that are pretty impressive. They are pretty bold. Let's go back and read about Gideon that we mentioned earlier. Turn over to Judges 7. During this time, there were all these city-states where one would attack another, and sometimes you and your villages would stand up against another village and protect yourself. And it was sort of this lawless time that Gideon found himself in. And God chose at that time to raise him up to destroy some of the idolatry that was going on in his land and to get rid of some of the antagonists that were around them. And he did some pretty powerful work through Gideon. It was one of those stories we look at. Judges 7, starting in verse 6. And the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men. What does that mean? It's about 30,000 men that came together to help Gideon out to defeat their enemies. Now, they had a much bigger force that they had to fight. And 30,000 against hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions. We don't even know how many there were. That's a pretty impressive victory. But as we read through the story, and we won't take the time to do it today, we know the story. We've read it many times. God wanted to do something big. And to do something big, he couldn't have them have this massive army. And you say 30,000 is nothing against 3 million or 30 million. But still, 30,000. That's a lot. you know, in Bend, we have 30, 40 people come to church. I come here and wow, big church. Not like when I was a kid, when there would be 400 in a room. But size is relative. And for them, 30,000 was a pretty big number. God said, there's too many. So he weeded them down. And there was less. There was 10,000. God says, there's still too many. So he told them to bring them to a creek and have them all drink. And he told them to separate them in this way. Those that kneeled down and lapped with their hands to, as if ready to jump up in battle, those are the people you'll take with you. And of the thousands that were there, 300 of them was all he got. Now, Gideon had the benefit of knowing that God had said, this is going to happen. You are going to be given a victory. Those 300 didn't have that. Those 300 didn't get to read Judges and see it for themselves. Those 300 had to go completely on what Gideon just said. That's faith. That is living by faith. That is saying God's strong hand is here and I'm going to live as if I've seen it myself. But all the rest of the people got down on their knees to drink water. And then the Lord said to Gideon, by the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and deliver the Midianites into your hand. Let all the other people go, every man to his place. So the people took the provisions and the trumpets in their hands, and he sent all away the rest of Israel, every man to his tent, and retained those 300 men. That's pretty impressive. I'd like to have Mr. Kester come up and explain what those guys were thinking. Whisper that. I think I would have been a little nervous if I was one of the 300. Why did he send everybody home? What are we going to do? How are we going to fight them? How many people were there? Gideon's army was reduced from 32,000 to 300. How many would they fight? Verse 12. Now the Midianites and Amalekites, all the people of the east, were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts. And their camels were without number. How many is that? How many is without number? And if you were one of those 300, how confident are you that God's strong hand would be in your life? Romans 5. Romans 5. Starting in verse 1. You know, we know that we will have trials and tribulations in this life. Nobody goes and gets up in the day and say, yep, it's going to be another perfect day. Nothing bad's ever going to happen to me. We know that we will have trials and tribulations in our lives. In verse 1 of Romans 5, therefore, having been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we also have access by faith into this grace in which we stand. Rejoice in hope and the glory of God. And not only that, but also glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulations produce perseverance, and perseverance character, and character hope. Those 300 people needed hope. Those 300 people needed perseverance. And as you know the story, Gideon divided them in half. It's 300. We don't need 300 over here. You guys go over there. We got this. Now you're in 150. How do you feel? How much do you think they were thinking, we got this. Barely 100 of us. We got this. If you study the founding of Israel, they had just such a situation. From the time of the Holocaust, the Jewish populations of Western and Eastern Europe were decimated. Over 6 million killed, families destroyed, broken up. Those that survived the Holocaust were sickly, were malnourished. Many of them could never, ever have a family again. Their lives were pretty much just wrecked with horror. And over the next couple years, there started to be this hope that there would be a homeland for the Jews, that maybe something might happen. If you were a betting man in 1947 and you said, will Israel get a homeland? The odds were against it. The odds were way against it. Some felt guilty for what happened to the Jews. But the 20th century was going to become a mechanized world in need of oil. And the place where that oil was in abundance were people you wanted to keep happy. The British wanted to keep the Arabs happy. The United States wanted to keep the Arabs happy. And yet, there was this Jewish question. And people were migrating in there under the nose of the British that were protecting Israel. It was called Palestine. It wasn't called Israel. Palestine comes from a Hebrew word for Philistia. Ever since the time of the Greeks, it's been known as Palestine. The Greeks, not a big fan of the Hebrews, looked at that area and wouldn't refer to it as Israel. Wouldn't think of it as a place for God's people. They called it Palestine, as if the Philistines somehow owned and had right to that land. And to all this time, it's been called Palestine. It's been an insult to God all along. God gave that land to a people, and they will call it by any other name. I think it's a mystery that people won't recognize Israel. It's God that they reject. And so in 1948, when the United Nations met and discussed this, it barely passed. The United States is the country that put them over the vote limit, allowed it to happen. There were so many countries that abstained to vote, including Britain, who were okay with the idea of Israel having a homeland, but didn't want to upset the Arabs and decided not to vote. And so the United States got the credit for putting them over the top. And so as the date came to allow Israel to become a state, and the idea was a two-state. That was the idea, two-state solution. There'd be a Palestine state and an Israel state. The Arab League completely rejected the idea. They said, we will not abide by a two-state solution. It will not happen. So as the time ticked down for Israel to become a state, as it became closer and closer, the plans were drawn up to eliminate Israel off the face of the earth. At the time, many of the diplomats in these countries were saying, this is going to be worse than the Holocaust. You see, Israel didn't have an army in 1948. I watched a documentary a little while ago on the Israeli Air Force, the birth of the Israeli Air Force. And the documentary starts out, in 2 weeks, Israel will declare its statehood. In 2 weeks, they will be attacked. And as they pan out, there's these two tiny airplanes, Piper Cubs, that were flying across the Mediterranean in the dark of night, without navigation, without anything other than they put a whole bunch of fuel tanks into a plane and removed everything else so they could get these planes to Israel. This was Israel's Air Force 2 weeks before the Arabs would attack. Israel had a very difficult job trying to figure out how they were going to defend themselves, because they knew that when they declared their independence, they would be immediately attacked. The plans were being drawn up. There was what the Arabs or the British called a civil war in Palestine, where the Jews and the Palestinians had been at each other's throats for many, many years. There was the kind of things that we see today around the world. Terrorist bombings, blowing up shops, shootings in the streets. And Israel had a small force with some small arms, very small force, of people that over the last couple of years have been training themselves in the desert how to fight. A handful of soldiers. The United States didn't want to be involved in the coming war that they knew was going to happen. Although they voted for statehood, President Truman decided it would be bad public relations to sell Israel arms and went as far as to put an arms embargo against selling arms to Israel. Now, it wouldn't have been so bad if he did the same thing for the Arab countries, but the Arab countries were well equipped. Because after World War II, the best of all of the surplus the Allies had were sold for oil. The Egyptians had British Spitfires, British Hurricanes, Comet tanks, Sherman tanks. The Syrians had the same, as well as all of the other nations that surrounded them. They were well equipped. A few weeks before the battle started, Israel's tank force took shape. One British soldier decided this isn't right, and he drove a British Comet tank out of a depot yard and into the hands of the British, or the awaiting Jews. And that one British Comet tank became the start of Israel's tank force. One tank. They went to a graveyard of broken tanks and resurrected 10 Sherman tanks from broken parts. And those 11 tanks became the tank force that would stand against thousands of tanks. Do we forget that God can do anything in our lives? Do we somehow allow doubt to filter in to where we say, you know, I don't think God's going to get me out of this one. This one might be too big for God. You know, the Red Sea, I think he can handle that. But my problems, they're tough. Do we ever think that way? As the date grew near, there was only one country in the world that decided to ignore the embargo, the arms embargo against Israel. Yugoslavia. There was a factory there that had built during the war Nazi airplanes. Messerschmitt's ME-109s. They were building those. And they said, Israel, do you want some planes? When Israel got around to trying to get to them, they needed pilots. And the way they got pilots is they went to America and London and they looked up registers of retired aviation pilots. And they looked for people with Jewish-sounding names. And they said, do you want to fight for Israel? Israel's first Air Force had pilots that were not Israeli. They were Jewish Americans, Jewish Britons, and some people from even Palestine joined in. The first planes that came out of the first fighter planes that came off the assembly line were not what you call ready for battle. The planes themselves were in pretty good shape, but the engine factory that used to build these engines was burned down in some labor dispute. So they had no engine for any of their planes. So somebody got the idea that maybe they could take these engines out of a bomber and try to strap them onto these planes. And the first pilots that flew them, they said, these are death traps. If they got off the ground, they will surely come down, probably on their own accord. When Israel declared their independence, the Arab League began their onslaught to attack. The area that Israel was given was this really long sliver. You think Israel today is this kind of a narrow country. It was much narrower than that. It was this corridor in a couple places, only a couple miles wide. How do you defend a corridor that's a couple miles, 10 miles wide from north to south? The Palestinian was given a state on the left and on to the right. And down the middle, this little strip was given to the Jews. And so this little ragtag of a few thousand men, armed only with light arms, they had no heavy machine guns, they had no mortars, they had those 11 tanks. And just in time for the battle to start, they got some American aircraft that were used for cargo planes, and they sort of shanghaied them out of America. They gave Jewish Americans cash, and they bought these cargo planes and said, this is going to be Polish's airline, a Polish airline. And they got in the planes and they flew them to Czechoslovakia. And once in Czechoslovakia, they took these Messerschmitts, these German Nazi planes. They gave the pilots. One pilot was saying, you know, I'm sitting in this German plane in a German uniform. It removed the German Luftwaffe wings from it with a German parachute and a German helmet. And he says, what's a good Jewish boy doing in a plane like this? They took these planes apart, they put them inside these cargo planes, and they got four of them flown to Israel, to Tel Aviv. The battle had already started. The Egyptians were coming in from the south. In Israel, everyone was told they had to become a soldier. You fight, or we all die. In men, Israel started out with 10,000 people. We'll call them people because they weren't all men. They were refugees with hours or even days of training. They had light arms. They were invaded from the north and south, from the east, by Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, with many, many more men, but with the best equipment that you could buy. They were trained. They knew how to fly their planes. They knew how to drive their tanks. They knew how to use their weapons. On May 15th, after the Declaration of Independence, Egypt attacked from the south with thousands of troops, tanks, artillery, and planes. And in the south, Israel had a few villages with a few hundred people. Few hundred. And in one instance, in one engagement, 100 Israelis, armed only with rifles, held up a column of tanks and 2,500 men for 5 days. Kind of Gideon-like. 100 people with rifles held up 2,500. And they had tanks. The Midianites had camels. I'm more afraid of a tank than a camel. Why was it important that God was with those 100 men? Because Israel was busy trying to build an air force to protect themselves. They had 4 airplanes that they had assembled the night before. They had been flown in the day before. And that night, they were assembling them. While they were assembling them in a hangar, the Egyptian army came and bombed the hangar next door, blew up the other hangar, the empty one. They were told that next day, you need to launch. They said, we need another day. And they said, tomorrow they'll be in Tel Aviv. You launch today or there is no Israel. 4 German Messerschmitts ME-109s flown by volunteer pilots from other countries attacked over 500 Egyptian tanks, armored personnel carriers, and trucks. These four Nazi aircraft, one of them came down under its own power because it just was so hastily put together, caused the entire Egyptian army to halt. Because Israel had a few troops they had up in the north trying to stop the Syrians, the Iraqis, the Jordanians, and all of them from coming across the border in that narrow stretch. They had no defense against the entire Egyptian army coming up from the south. They had four Nazi aircraft. After that attack, the Egyptians halted. They said they were overwhelmed, they needed reinforcements, and they declared a ceasefire. Over the next month, Israel began to get stronger. They began to get more and more arms. And eventually, they defeated their Arab attackers. History books still don't call it miraculous. But this happened in our time. Not in Bible times. This happened in our time. Because we know that God is going to do something huge. He is going to do something magnificent to bring about His kingdom of God. And we talk about it, but is it real to us? Is it real that what He is going to be doing? Is it real what He's doing in our lives? The people who lived through that never doubted that God's was involved in their lives. They saw it firsthand. Let's not just think of the stories from our Bible as ancient history. That just because we didn't hear God tell His angelic host, Israel's going to win this battle, that God's strong hand isn't alive in our lives, working overseas, working in our country, working in our lives. Let's remember that God has a plan for us. And let's never forget God's strong hand in our lives.